Good afternoon and welcome, San Diego. How's it going?
Yeah.
So as they say, we've saved the best for the last. So thank you for hanging in and joining us for the session today. We are here to talk about the lifeblood of our industry, deposits, right? And the one question that we want to answer today is how do traditional institutions, financial institutions, fight the biggest battle for deposits that they have had in a century? I know some of you feel the pain and they relate with what I'm saying day in, day out, but some of you are like, yeah, she's just being too dramatic. Well, let me put some things in context, okay? Let's talk about generational shifts. I don't have a very clear sight of you, but let's take a poll. How many Gen Zs here in the audience?
We are one.
Oh, yeah. And how many millennials there? Okay. I'm hoping there are no Gen Alphas, like my daughter won't come to a conference right now, but how many Gen Xers? Okay. So that gives us some sense of. Now let's put the Gen Z. We only have one person, so I won't take that as a summation of the poll, but like let's put the Gen Z trend to perspective, right? So ProSight did this annual deposit survey. And they found that only 9% of Gen Zs actually quote their community bank as their primary banking relationship. And that number has fallen from 12% in 2024. 35% of Gen Zs and 32% of millennials basically, definitely, or probably plan to change their banks within the next 6 months. These are the generational aspects of it, and we will definitely delve more into that. Then we have the challenger banks and now even the non-banks who are out here to cater to all the functions that a bank does, like send money, receive money, hold money. You've heard this throughout the conference these last 3 days, right? And I haven't even started about the whole economic situation that we are in, the macro challenges, the consumer spending, how people want to kind of prioritize how they're putting money to work. But yeah, I mean, let's take a breath. I didn't mean to scare off people about this, but I think the idea that I want to put across is let's get a sense of the magnitude of this issue. And we are so blessed today that we have the amazing, diverse panel where you have experts who are fighting this battle at the front line, and we have them to kind of come in and address each of those issues as we go through it. So I'd love to invite you ladies to just kind of get the stage conversation going. Maybe we can start with you, Angela. Like, how do you look at this issue? And like, what is your take on the, when Katie basically sent you that you got to talk about this topic?
Yeah, on a high level, I think, and if I can balance out your, you were saying before how we don't want to inspire fear, I can bring I can ground us a little bit in that by inviting us to avoid a scarcity mindset. The current M2 money supply is $22 trillion, more than that. So, like, there's plenty of liquidity in the marketplace to be had. That said, I'm not trying to step on the very real challengers that are in the marketplace that banks are facing right now. But we've got that. We've got many years of centuries of structural tailwinds at our backs. So there's we do still have quite a bit of opportunity to take advantage of the enormous liquidity that's available to us. And I think the opportunities that I see, the first few that came to mind when I was contacted about this, are how we can really lean into experience. I just followed some of the panelists that were on the CX track, and I famously say to a lot of folks that delight can be a deposit strategy. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Also, finding a way to differentiate. I think banks have been coddled by this idea of sameness, and we tend to lean on that because it is very safe to feel like you are embedded in something and a part of something. But I don't think that we are aware enough about the risk of being unremarkable. So those are the few things that are top of mind for me today.
Karen, how are you thinking about this?
Yeah, so my clients are affiliated and independent broker dealers, and deposits is sort of a foreign concept for one side of that coin, where the affiliated broker dealer has always wanted to capture kind of the full financial relationship of their clients. Now independent broker dealers are certainly focused more on how can they capture some of that share of wallet. And really, we're still dealing with the impacts of cash sorting that happened in 22-23, and largely what firms were doing then, whether they lagged, which most did way too long in the rising rate cycle, and lost 20-30% of their wealth deposits. The firms that that got ahead of yield have continued to grow, but it's expensive. And those who lagged, even if they tried to adjust their strategy over the past kind of 2 years, have not been able to make up that ground. And so there's this real competition for that everyday banking relationship, because firms know that it increases the revenue of the total client relationship by as much as 30% when you have the investments and primary banking relationship. And then also that attrition is essentially zero when you have that. The only time that a client kind of leaves is, gosh, it's going to be morbid, if they die, or if their advisor goes to another firm and they have a close enough relationship that they want to follow them there. So it's a really interesting dynamic right now to have everyone who used to focus solely on that fee-based advisor relationship focusing on deposits.
So Stacy, you work with a lot of clients on this as well, right? Like, let's hear from you. Like, why are deposits so important?
Deposits are key, and I'll provide a little bit of context to the work I do, which will inform my answer. So I work in this middle space, helping fintechs as vendors partner with banks and credit unions, but also I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that I work with community banks that are getting into the embedded type of strategy, so embedded finance. Both of those two perspectives lend themselves to seeking additional deposits and or providing avenues for banks to acquire additional deposits. If I look at this from the fintech side, I think a very common or powerful type of conversation that a fintech can have with the bank or credit union is how you might be able to attract additional deposits on behalf of that credit union. And guess what? It doesn't always have to be super sexy technology. There's a number of solutions that we've seen this week or that exist out there in the industry right now that may not have the glitz and the glamour. They may not even have AI in their solution, believe it or not, and we've heard that a lot, but they're helping an institution acquire additional deposits. That's key, because I don't speak with many bankers today that are not in a scenario where they are looking to acquire additional deposits. And that's why I think so many organizations are evaluating an embedded finance strategy and are launching deposit-related embedded finance strategies. They're out there partnering with fintechs that are hoping to bring more deposits to their organization, and there are substantial upsides that can be established in those types of relationships. So from my point of view, I think that there's just this overwhelming sense right now that everyone is interested in deposits. Everyone wants to fuel the lending machine at their organization. And there's so many opportunities present here in this room and outside in these halls that are going to enable that to occur.
Yeah. I mean, having covered banks for over a decade, it kind of is very obvious, like deposits is pretty much the lifeblood for every and any bank, right? But just to kind of fill in the fourth aspect of what we talked about on stablecoins, we've done a ton of work around the evolution of stablecoins, and what our deep dive report kind of alludes and suggests is they have moved past the stage from being pure play crypto on-ramps and off-ramps. Now they're kind of finding their way into mainstream financial infrastructure. And if you were to read the tea leaves, you've seen the large institutions like your Citis of the world and JPMs of the world bringing in and offering all these tokenized digital asset services, stablecoins, or even digital deposits or tokenized deposits for moving money across the world in real time, programmable money, and all of the benefits that we've all discussed at the conference. Our value projection for this is stablecoins could come up to $50 trillion worth of transactions by 2030. And that's a serious number. And if you compare it with what the U.S. Treasury kind of talked about, it poses about $6.6 trillion worth of deposit threat if they start offering yields. So So those are the four areas that we think like we want to kind of address a little bit more. And let's kind of get into the conversation around the reality of liquidity, if I may. So Angela, let me start with you. With all the competition from different asset types, how do banks keep the money trapped long enough to matter? Or, I mean, is trapped the wrong word or wrong thought on how to approach deposits?
I think it's a great question. I don't know if I love trapped. I think maybe we reconsider it. Do you guys journey back in time with me to like 2 years ago when we were all talking about faster payments, right? And we all wanted faster payments. I have great news. We did it. Congrats, everybody. The payments are fast and the money is moving. So liquidity moves faster. It's not, deposits aren't staying as idle as they used to, but, banks do have an opportunity to reconsider how we magnetize those deposits. And I was talking to one of the founders here who demoed actually our first demo from Retiv. Shout out to Retiv. But we were talking about banking relationships and a banking relationship that a business would choose, and this person had shared that he chose his bank based on the fact that it was really easy to make payments. And it reminded me like, oh yeah, if you love something, set it free and it will come back to you, or whatever that quote is that I paraphrased. But if we make it also worth noting that he mentioned there was like a joy in making a payment and being able to set up an ACH template where instead of having a loading wheel for uploading the ACH instructions, it like had a very interactive looking design to how you see that experience and what that digital experience was like. And something like that makes a difference where it's like, it's actually kind of fun to make my payments and they make it very, very easy to accomplish. So I think if banks look less at how do we trap this here and how do we...
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 V, CN20210130.
We keep and hold on to it, and I understand why we have that reaction, but if we're looking at it more of how do I make it super easy for my people to send their money will come to me by default.
So let's do another poll. How many of you have actually visited your bank branch in the last 3 months? Let's see a raise of hands. So 2, 3, 5, 6. Yeah, so we have like about 20% of the audience who's done that. And how many of you have accounts with non-banks, like be it a Venmo account or a Challenger Bank or a crypto or whatever? Yeah, see, that's a significant number. So even bank branch visitors have alternative accounts now. Stacey, I want to bring you in here. Where is the disconnect in the way bankers see deposits and in the way customers see deposits?
I don't want to paint with too broad of a brushstroke here, but I'm going to take a little bit of a liberty. Having started my career in banking and then branched out working for a large fintech, I think that at least the organizations that I had worked for viewed deposits as transactional. And some of you may have had the experience of banking with organizations that even had sales-related goals. You might work for one of those organizations that have sales-related goals on opening new accounts of various types. I think when we approach a customer's very valuable deposit relationship with a transactional lens, we have an inherent misalignment. Because those customers, every time I've opened an account at a bank, and I do have several of traditional financial relationships and the fintech relationships and a variety of others, just I call it market research. You guys can call it whatever you want. But in this regard, though, I'm seeking a relationship. I am seeking an experience. I am seeking an opportunity to be wowed, delighted. As you mentioned, Angela, I know you'll tell us a little bit more about that. So when there is that disconnect between the two parties involved in this type of deposit relationship, it doesn't always lend itself to keeping that money magnetized, back to Angela's earlier point.
So that's a very good point, right? Like, and if you think about it from there was also a period of time when interest rates were low, and then when interest rates rose, like it's just the way banks have approached deposits has kind of also evolved from a point of where your lending balance sheet was, or like what was the strategy on that end. But I want to come to the, I'll come back to this. Like the other part I want to kind of address, and let me bring you in on this, Corinne. But before that, let's take an audience poll. How many folks have actually put money to work or invested in the stock market in the last year? I'm rephrasing the question. How many have not invested in the stock market last year? Is there any one person? So that's what I'm talking about. So it's not just the competition of putting money to work, which is not sitting in deposits, it's actually invested and active. But Corinne, tell me, like, from a wealth perspective, where, I mean, now the bankers of the world are coming in and competing with the banks, traditional banks. It's not just the money for investing, but also actual deposits are going to wealth managers. How can you see this unfold? And also, like, how much of stepping on toes is happening here? And how is that conversation happening? Are banks realizing that?
Yeah, it's been interesting to see sort of over the past maybe 5 to 7 years, every traditional bank creates a mass affluent strategy, right? Everyone's going after the mass affluent. And the goal there is that those people will age up. They will become wealth clients. On the flip side, you have every independent broker dealer saying, how can we create a bank partnership, have banking as a service, get a charter, or within our brokerage rails, create a product that can compete for deposits, because they have the investments of these clients and they have these really solid relationships and they want that share of wallet, and they don't need to compete always for the entirety of the deposits wallet. With all the cash sorting that's happening, they want to compete for that, what we call tomorrow money, kind of the savings that's not sitting in your checking account, but you want to keep liquidity. And so there's this interesting shift that broker-dealers realize that they can compete with a high-yield savings account from a digital bank, or that they can compete with having a transactional account and cash management that mirrors a lot of the functionality that their clients need in a checking account. So it's really, it's a dynamic shift over the past just couple of years for these broker-dealers to want to play in this space.
Yeah, so there is definitely stepping on toes. Like, there is no argument about that. But, like, now you also have the Coinbases of the world coming in, and, like, everything and anything that you can do with money in flow or money at home, like, it's kind of coming in and playing on that. But I think it's time to kind of bring the question further beyond. Like, we're talking about the battle of moneyness in a way. And, Angela, let me bring you in on this. You mentioned Delight as a deposit strategy, and I think that's a wonderful idea. But when you think about the average U.S. savings interest rate that has gone down to, say, 0.38% APY last month. On the other hand, you have, like, top-line challenger banks and digital asset platforms that are offering yields of, like, 5% plus. How can the bank's human experience compete with that 5% yield, which is available on a phone? I know I've put you on the spot, but you have to help our
No, it's okay. Like any good banker, I don't really want to talk about pricing. When I say Delight as a strategy, I don't mean, like, I'm not necessarily saying that banks need to be more cute, although I could, in a different panel, argue that we should, present company excluded, be a little cuter. What I mean by that is, how do we absolve confusion and absolve frustration and do that in a proactive way? How do we make things feel like it is, it's like you were just saying, how do you just make things feel better? I was talking earlier with one of us, a colleague, a friend at the conference, and we were discussing the concept of the rational consumer. And I think we a lot of times as bankers assume that the people across desks from us, businesses and individuals alike, are making rational decisions based on price. And yeah, a lot of us are, right? Like, there's a huge difference between like 50 basis points and 4%. But there's many other factors that go into making a decision about banking and where you keep your money.
Tell me, what does the bank bring to the table?
What does the bank bring to the table? We have to be a place to be trusted. And this is an interesting question, and I don't have a perfect answer for you, because it's something that, since the panel that I sat in on earlier with, I can't remember the title of it, but one of your colleagues, Olivia, had mentioned studies that it's banks that have I might get this wrong, Olivia, please spare me. Banks that have relationships that originate in branches hold on to those relationships for a lot longer than when they originate digitally. Hmm. And then it's like, oh, well, I was like immediately drawn to that. Like, well, how do we bring people in? And there was Capital One was on that panel. We all know that they do a very good job of creating and really leaning into like, how do we create a third space and how do we reconsider what banking is? But the reason I don't have a perfect answer for you is I can't think of many of us that have really nailed it. And a lot of us talk right now about having highly differentiated client experiences and wanting to invest in experience strategies. I don't know that many of us could really articulate exactly what that is, nor could we articulate what that's going to be.
Yeah. No, I think you're saying it's an imperfect answer because you're looking at it as a problem to solve. But I think what you said was very interesting. And I'm sure a lot of Gen Xers and millennials in our audience relate with that, right? It's trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like even today, I will not park my entire deposit base with like a challenger bank or a Coinbase. I will not. And I'm sure a lot of us kind of understand that. I think to your point, the idea is to kind of how do you leverage on that trust and build on it? And like, so I think that is an imperfect, perfect answer. So
yeah. And I think one more thing, and I know we have time. We're trying to keep it tight, but understand your client journey literally do that. That was guidance that was shared before. It's something I share all the time, but I think we can't overstate or over encourage in one another is to like deeply understand what your customers go through with your people and digitally understand how you're making your employees feel and also brand experience is big too, but I think we'll probably get into that down the road.
That's good. So Stacey, mm-hmm. you're watching deposits move from useful experiences to useful experiences rather than just a parking spot, right?
For sure.
Talk to us, what has changed in how deposit growth, people are basically approaching deposit growth, and what are the smart players doing differently in your view?
Yeah, and I think I want to tack on from what Angela just said as far as the smart players. The technology that interests me the most that I'm seeing out there today relative to deposit strategies being deployed within banks and credit unions are those things that do the aspects that are part of the job, they do it better, or they empower a banker to do their job more easily or in a more just professional manner. And hear me out on this. I'm not suggesting bankers are not professional right now, but in some cases, I'm thinking about my first role as a banker. I went through some teller training. That's where I started. And there wasn't a lot about how to be a banker. It was a lot about how to key in transactions. It wasn't a great deal about how to interact with a customer. So as I moved up from a teller then to a personal banker, the conversation felt differently when I was trying to position a time deposit account to a customer. That became a very rate-centric type of discussion. And I think many of you all have been there before. A customer that says, well, I can get rate XYZ down the road. You're telling me this is the best that you can do. Can you call someone and get me a better rate? And a lot of bankers, that is their experience. It's either a no, I watch the money leave the organization and perhaps even the entire relationship, or I call somebody for a rate. I'm working with a founder right now that has developed a solution that has changed the narrative for that banker, and the conversation becomes much more less rate-centric, but more guiding the banker through alternatives, different rate opportunities, different term opportunities. And rates, I should say, within comfort level, a ceiling, a parameter level that a bank is comfortable with. So to bring it all back to the question that was asked, the things that I think we should be looking at are those experiences in banking, those opportunities or the products that allow our people to be better, that allow us to offer perhaps even some of the same products we already have better, rather than just the shiny ones out there that we're all paying attention to because we're all at these events. So that's something that resonates with me right now.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. And I mean, I just look at the way the industry is kind of evolved as well, right? You look at the large banks, obviously deposits like the JP Morgan's and Citi's of the world, like when they approach something like a stable coin, which is obviously detrimental to their inherent deposit base, it's just interesting to see how they have evolved and started offering that as a side option for customers who are already ready to move. I would think of it as a hedging strategy more than like a me too way to kind of go in and self-cannibalize yourself. But at least that gives you that optionality to kind of stay in the game. And the other areas that we've been hearing is like the custodian banks for, say, stablecoin money flows. And like, so there are these evolving modalities that are coming through. Corinne?
请关注公众号思维纪要社，更多纪要请加 VCN20210130.
I have a simpler question for you. Has the traditional banking and broker-dealer model broken? Like, I know Gen Zs and the younger generations, we've heard they like to have multiple relationships with banks. And actually, let's not put that frame in there because even our Gen Xers have like multiple non-bank financial relationships. How does one think about loyalty and stickiness in that construct then?
Yeah, I think that the concept of having multiple relationships is here to stay. And those who are willing to just accept that are going to be better off. But when we think about, we have research that shows that next gen high net worth clients are significantly more likely to want to have their investments and their advised investments and their primary banking relationship at the same institution. And some of my colleagues would argue, well, they'll age out of that. And I really think if you look back at the great financial crisis when there was JP Morgan and Chase, there was Merrill and there was Bank of America, they weren't together, that there was no incentive for clients who had their investments one place and their banking relationship someplace else to bring them together. Whereas now next gen sees the benefit in having that kind of primary relationship all at the same place while they also have money with a fintech and they want their self-directed accounts with another institution. And so just embracing the fact that you're not going to have the entirety of the relationship is certainly better than struggling to try and trap anything.
Yeah, and I think that's a fantastic point also from the lens that there is synergy for a bank just in terms of how much of your customer do you know, right? With having all those multiple touch points. And as we all know, the profitability curve acceleration kind of kicks in the more interactions you have with your customer from that lens. I think we're very close to time, but let's do a quick roundup on what is the one defensive strategy that you guys recommend people to take away from the conversation here, like what can they do differently today to defend or to fight that battle more effectively? Maybe I'll start with you, Angela.
I'm thinking because I want to be concise, but while I'm thinking to try to be concise, I'm wasting time.
So let me say it differently. Like, what is – you said about you said blending in is really a growth strategy, right? How do you – what is the one bold decision that banks can make today to – stand out or to differentiate?
Oh, I think the easiest way I would sum this up is to just like start to think boldly about what we could do differently. I was really, Stacey, I was really compelled by your comments about your client who's kind of reimagined their advisory model for their customers and saying like, hey, instead of me advising you to the thing that I want you to do, there's very real options out here. I can be the person and I could be the source of helping to eliminate some of that confusion and giving you the right guidance to have that happen, even if that means it's not always going to be wholly with me, but that might mean you'll come back to me for some of this and trust me. But yeah, then like I mentioned a second ago, be very real about what you are and who you are for your customers. In both an experience and brand perspective that I could talk about all day, so I will end it there. I think big, think differently.
Yeah, think big, think differently. Corinne, again, I'm going to taper the question for you. Capturing everyday relationships can increase revenue by 30%, you said. If you're a bank CEO today, how do you defend your deposits against wealth managers?
Yeah. So in the wealth space, I think there's an ongoing fear that advisors are going to go away, and kind of every 10 years there's a different reason for why everyone thinks advisors will go away. Our research also shows that next gen high net worth clients are even more likely to seek the advice of an advisor that they pay for. The difference is that they have the expectation of every digital capability to complement that relationship. And in the wealth management space, we are easily 15 years behind retail banking. And so getting digital capabilities for advice, planning, deposits, value prop, product, all of it need to align. We're going to get the Oscar music.
I'll be brief. I'll be brief. I suggest you go out and query through your deposit transaction files to look to see where your customers are sending their money and stay open and take a look at ways in which you can intercept or reacquire that.
Well, have you ever seen a more efficient panel than that? Thank you so much for joining us. And my key to takeaway from the lovely ladies is here is that there is comfort in sameness. But I think you need to be a little bit bold. You have to decide what, how safe is not safe and how you can kind of take that one bold step to differentiate and stand out in this environment. Thank you so much. You've been a lovely audience. Nice to be here today.